This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On any given Saturday, does Garrett Gomez sit? Todd Pletcher has to hope the horse will never spit the bit, but any given Saturday is not his only hope. He's saddling up four others, for Todd Pletcher is no dope. He figures if you go with five, your Derby chances grow. A storm in May could break his heart, and so could Tiago. Joining me now to let us all know whether any given Saturday, Storm in May, and Tiago are even still entered in today's Kentucky Derby is Jenny Reese, who has picked the winner in each of the past 10 Derbies for us and also hit the superfecta in each of the past four. So why she's still working is still a mystery to me. But Jenny, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, it's great being back. Loved your poem there.
Before you reveal the winner of today's Derby, let's take a little bit of time to talk about last year's winner. I understand that tributes to Barbaro will be evident at Churchill Downs today.
That's right. Barbaro was one of the most popular horses to come through in some years for the Kentucky Derby. His popularity only grew as he had his dramatic fight for his life for 8 months and then ended up succumbing, not to the severe fractures that he suffered 2 weeks after the Kentucky Derby in the Preakness, but for the insidious foot disease, laminitis. It's such a problem for the horse industry.
Barbaro tributes aside, it seems to me that there has been less pre-race hyperbole this spring than in any other spring. I wonder if you agree, and if so, why that is.
Well, I do agree, and I think one reason could be there's three people that are missing. For the first time since 1980, you do not have a horse in the Kentucky Derby trained by Wayne Lucas, or Bob Baffert, or Nick Zito. They've combined for 4, 3, 7, 9 Kentucky Derbies and really dominated in the 90s. So it does seem a little quieter without them around, but it's been entertaining because it's what we in the press consider like new meat, you know, to cover and find out these new personalities, and there's some really interesting stories this year.
Well, I've been studying significant numbers that have to do with a Derby, and I have learned that 155,000 people on hand for the race will eat nearly 3,000 pounds of barbecue shrimp and drink 100,000 mint juleps. But is there any number connected with this race more impressive than the number of horses trainer Todd Pletcher will send to the post?
A record-tying 5 horses, and he could have had 7 in here, but he chose to run the filly Rags to Riches in yesterday's Kentucky Oaks, and the horse that finished 2nd in the Santa Anita Derby, he chose to wait for the Preakness with. But he could legitimately have had 7. Todd Pletcher has only been training about 11 years, and he already ranks 3rd all-time in purse earnings in the sport's history at like $121 million. He has a less glowing record, though, in the Kentucky Derby. He is 0-14, which makes him the losingest trainer to not win the Derby in Kentucky history. But in fairness to him, his first one was only in 2000. He's going to win the Derby one of these days, and it certainly could be this afternoon.
What do the other trainers have to say about this guy who's got 5 horses, a full quarter of the field?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what Steve Asmussen, who has the program favorite, Perlin, said about Todd Pletcher. He said, "When I grow up, I want to be Todd Pletcher."
All right, what's my best choice for a long shot this afternoon?
Actually, with 20 betting interest, you're going to get some unbelievable prices on some of these horses. And you take a horse like Dominican, who is 2-for-2 as a gelding. He's also 3-for-3 on all-weather synthetic tracks, known as Poly Track. Mm-hmm. And some people think that that's why he won the Bluegrass by a nose-over champion Street Sense. But I think Dominican, the gelding, has helped them. They call it the ultimate equipment change.
Mm-hmm.
And he could be a surprise to come flying and hit the board at a very big price, as could Tiago, who is the half-brother to Giacomo, who was 50-1 when he won the Derby 2 years ago. They call Tiago like Giacomo, but with a little bit more speed. No mare has ever produced 2 Kentucky Derby winners, so that would be very historic. I like him to come running and hit the board at a big price. And then there's also Zanjero, who was 3rd by a total of a head in the Bluegrass Stakes. He's the stablemate of Perlin with Steve Asmussen, and I think he could be 40-50-1 and hit the board.
The Derby attracts an awful lot of people who make their bets on something other than past performance or speed figures. Many of these people base their wagers on horses' names. Any given Saturday and Storm in May would seem to be well-named for this race. Does either of them have a shot?
Any given Saturday has a huge shot. And when they named them, they did have this particular Saturday in mind. Storm in May, he's going to be 60-70-1. And The trainer's a wonderful person, Bill Kaplan. He has two horses in this race, and he only has about six horses in his whole stable. He picked up a few two-year-olds, so he's a little few more. But definitely has the smallest. He didn't pay much money. I mean, Pat Pletcher probably spends more on his stable pony than these thoroughbreds cost that are now in the Kentucky Derby. But here's the hunch bet for the Derby is I'm a wild and crazy guy. He's 50-1 in the program. But if everybody in the infield bets $2 on him, he'll probably go off about 8-1.
Jenny, for the first time in 133 years, all the Derby horses were administered surprise drug tests this week. What provoked that?
Oh, that's been an ongoing thing, as in lots of sports, for the Aretha Poeton, known as EPO. It's blood doping, essentially. And so this year, for the first time, unannounced, they take a blood sample on all the Derby horses that will be tested. If they find something that looks suspicious, they'll draw another blood, but they will not be able to have the confirmation done until after the Derby. I think it's a great thing. There should not be a suspicion about it. If they win, you need all the evidence that they're doing it cleanly, and I think everybody really welcomes this.
Okay, we've reached that point in the conversation where it's time for you to provide your annual sure thing. So who wins?
My annual sure thing is going to be a horse that breaks history, and it's going to be Street Sense. This is the year the Breeders' Cup Juvenile winner actually wins the Kentucky Derby, and it's also going to be the first time since 1979 that the two-year-old champion wins the Roses, and now we just have to hope that Carl Nasker, who trained Unbridled in 1990, can come up with another memorable TV moment, as he did when he won with Unbridled and told Mrs. Genter, he's going to win, I love you, Mrs. Genter. So we'll see what he does with Jim Taffel this afternoon.
Jenny Rees writes about the horses for the Louisville Courier-Journal and picks the winner for Only a Game each year at this time. Jenny, thank you very much.
Sure, Bill. Happy handicapping.
Barbaro's breakdown in last year's Preakness and the January euthanization of the 2006 Derby winner has many in the horse racing industry refocused on making racing safer for thoroughbreds. Some tracks in Kentucky, California, Canada, and the UK have made the switch to a synthetic surface called Polytrack, which is designed to prevent catastrophic injuries. But Polytrack has received mixed reviews from horsemen and women. Kathleen Adams of member station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, reports.
6 days before the Kentucky Derby, as barn workers rake the shed row, thoroughbred trainer Todd Pletcher takes a break from studying race conditions to meet with the media. Pletcher is horse racing's 2006 Trainer of the Year. And as of last Sunday, he had five prospects vying for the coveted Garland of Roses. But on that day, four of his Derby hopefuls, Cowtown Cat, Scat Daddy, Circular Key, and Any Given Saturday, are nowhere near Churchill Downs. Instead, the quartet is training some 77 miles east of Louisville.
Just felt like, you know, with the spring weather being sometimes unsettled, we could come to Keeneland, we could train on the Polytrack and not have to worry about rain or any of the other factors that might uproot your schedule.
Polytrack is a mixture of sand, synthetic fibers, and recycled rubber combined and coated with a microcrystalline wax that allows water to flow through it to a specially designed drainage system. Its proponents say it provides horses with a safer and more consistent running surface than typical dirt racetracks. And that, says Keeneland's racing director Rogers Beasley, is why 14 of the possible 20 Derby entrants were stabled at the Lexington racetrack a week prior to the Kentucky Derby.
It's the safety of the horse, safety, safety, safety. That's what we're interested in. That's what every racetrack's interested in. And we want to show that to the people that love our sport and to attract new fans.
Until her retirement late last week, Dr. Nancy Davis was chief state veterinarian for the Kentucky Horse Racing Authority and worked all five of the state's racetracks, two of which have the synthetic surface.
Polytrack has really been the biggest plus that I've seen for thoroughbred racing in the 33 years that I've been on the racetrack. It's made a surface that it's forgiving enough to the horse that it doesn't cause the injuries we were seeing on dirt.
On a warm spring morning, thoroughbreds exercise at Turfway Park in Florence, Kentucky. The facility was the first North American racetrack to install Polytrack. Even as three horses work in company, the thunder of hooves is noticeably absent. Pick up a handful of Polytrack, and pieces of old tires and remnants of red and green carpeting are revealed. It is this material Davis credits with decreasing the number of catastrophic breakdowns at Turfway Park, where in 2005 there were 13 fatalities during the first 2 months of the year.
And then in the what we call winter meet, which was January, February, March, and a week of April of 06, that first year we didn't have any catastrophic injuries at all. It was wonderful. It was remarkable. We went a month without even picking up a cut or anything. It was great.
But while there were no fatal injuries in early 2006, horsemen at Turfway started to report other problems. They complained about the polytrack surface balling up, collecting in hooves and shoes, and possibly causing the horse's legs to strike the ground unevenly. Terry Smith is an assistant to Kentucky trainer Greg Foley.
It wears and tears on their ankles and their joints, actually, you know, because they're not putting their foot down. They're rolling, you know, all over. So we tried, you know, spraying stuff in their feet and that, but a lot of times it was that bad we just didn't go out there. You know, just kept them in the barn.
Turfway Park President Bob Elliston says the racetrack worked closely with trainers and jockeys to correct the problem. But harsh winter weather made it difficult to maintain the synthetic surface. But Elliston says that dealing with maintenance problems is part of the learning curve, and he remains a strong proponent. He says since installing the surface, the track's maintenance costs have dropped by 60% and field sizes have increased. Elliston adds horsemen have endorsed Polytrack by opting to train their Derby contenders on it.
Typically what happens to these horses along the way are these nicks and pings. We rarely see the best horses have career-ending injuries along the Derby trail, but it just knocks them off training and it knocks them off that rigid schedule that you have to maintain to deliver them in the optimum position that first Saturday in May.
For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Florence, Kentucky.
It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, baseball's failure to draw black athletes even on college campuses historically populated by same. But first, on Thursday night, the news out of the West was decidedly good for fans of the Golden State Warriors, who, against the odds and their own history, have become comfortable in the NBA's postseason. The Warriors slipped by the Dallas Mavericks by 25 points to move into the second round of the playoffs. Joining me now to discuss this phenomenon is Oakland Tribune sports columnist Art Spander. Art, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Have you gotten all the confetti out of your hair yet?
Well, actually, I was hiding in the press room, but I'll tell you, I haven't got the noise out of my ears. Loudest crowd I can remember, except maybe the 1975 playoffs. Mm. But it was a record indoor crowd in California, which is pretty good. The Globetrotters once played at the L.A. Coliseum, 1952 or 3, outdoors with about 35 or 36,000 people. But they had three crowds in a row, each subsequently a little larger than the next one. And last night was something like 20,600, which in an arena that supposedly has 18,000 seats, that's pretty good. 19,000 seats, pretty good.
Was the Warriors' upset an example of one team overachieving, the favorite playing basketball with both hands firmly around its own neck, or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both, and the famous word in basketball, matchups. The Warriors had beaten them, I believe, six in a row over a two-year span, barely beaten anybody else except for the last month of the season, but somehow matched up very well. And, of course, part of that may be because Don Nelson, the Warriors coach, who was talked into returning this year, had been the both the Mavericks coach and general manager and knew their personnel very well.
It's been 15 years since the Warriors' last playoff series victory. Golden State plays in what used to be laid-back Northern California. Why do Warrior fans care so much about a team that has let them down so often?
That's a very good question. This has always been football country, and of course the 49ers winning five Super Bowls added to it. Winning in 75, and of course that's already 32 years ago, excited a lot of people, and once football ends in late December until baseball begins in April, there's only really one game in town. There's hockey in down in San Jose, but it's more of a cult sport. For years, when the Warriors, I mean, they won 17 games, they won 20 games, they won 22 games, and yet they draw 15,000 people. So now when they finally succeed, when they finally make it, everybody's here. We've become the new Hollywood. All of a sudden, Woody Harrelson's here, and Snoop Dogg is here, and I expect Jack Nicholson for the next series.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson in, I don't know, pick your player, but a Warriors jersey, right?
Yeah, and that is the TNT, the Charles Barkley business, where Barkley, having good fun, just chided the Bay Area. He didn't think the Warriors could win, and a lot of people didn't. And then he wore a Mavericks jersey on TV. And then he said, well, okay, the team is good, but the Bay Area is only people who were rejected by Southern California, which I get a kick because I grew up down there. I've been up here for 42 years. And where would you prefer to live? Where there's wine country, where there's Pebble Beach, and where you're 3 hours from skiing. And that doesn't include our six professional teams.
You mentioned the Warriors winning the NBA championship in 1975, but I'm wondering if upsetting the Mavericks in 2007 was actually a bigger deal.
It probably is because of the nature of media now. There was no ESPN. There was no 300 mini-cams every place you walked. I don't think as many people knew or cared. And now, of course, everything is national, and we're not Bush League. But I did reference Mike Wilbon, my friend who works for both the Washington Post. His column the other day was, I stayed up till 1:30 in the morning. The Warriors are must-see basketball. And, of course, we get a kick because everything is directed on East Coast time. Because of the nature today, you know, everybody knows everything, and so much television, so much radio, newspapers, and the Internet. Can't forget the Internet. Everybody knows what's going on, and each issue becomes much larger than it was 20, 30 years ago.
You use the phrase Warriors and must-see basketball, and I have to whack the side of my head with the palm of my hand to make sure I got that right.
Well, I read it twice. And, of course, Mike's an NBA guy. He works ESPN doing NBA, and he loves pro basketball, but he appreciates, you know, great stories. And this is certainly one. You got a feeling in game one that when the Warriors won in Dallas that they'd be doing very well. And Baron Davis in game six, he's making shots. He does the Willis Reed. He goes out with a pulled hamstring or a hamstring strain in the first quarter, and you hear this collective sigh. Oh, that's it. Here's the best player. He comes limping back in the second quarter, and he can't run, but he's throwing in 30-footers. And, of course, we were reminded of the New York Knicks in 1970. Willis Reed got hurt and mm-hmm. came back limping on the court. And how things, is it coincidental or are the gods of sport controlling things? But Marv Albert, the announcer in the Knicks game, was also the announcer last night.
You know, we've been looking back at some of the bad old days of the Warriors, but let's look forward a little bit. This team has a legitimate shot at going a lot further than the second round, no?
Yeah, they're going to have trouble with the winner of the next series. They play either Utah, which would be better for them, or Houston, which will be a very poor matchup. Whether they do or they don't, this team is on the move. And I wrote in the paper after the game, basically, it doesn't matter win or lose, but basketball has returned. The presence of basketball, the excitement of basketball, and it was like a college crowd. These three games, people chanting 20 minutes before tip-off, let's go Warriors. And you got guys in coats and ties and guys in tank tops, and it was just a lot of fun. And, of course, that's what sports is supposed to be. And over the years, with the steroids, with the holdouts, with the arrests, et cetera, you look and you say, you know, that famous line by Earl Warren, true or not, that he always read the sports pages first because that showed man's accomplishments, where the news side always showed what's wrong with us. And some days you wonder if he had it backwards when he sees all these problems in sports. But when you have a great few days of success and the people getting excited and enjoying it, then you think it's all worth it.
Art Spander is a sports columnist for the Oakland Tribune. Art, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Bill.
Much has been made recently about the fact that African American players comprise just 8% of Major League Baseball rosters, but in college baseball, that number is even lower. At last year's NCAA Division I College World Series between Oregon State and North Carolina, just 2% of the players were black. Even universities with a historical mission to educate black students are dealing with a lack of modern African-American baseball players, and no one is quite sure what to do about it. Dave DeWitt reports from Durham, North Carolina.
It's the first pitch of a recent game between North Carolina Central University and St. Augustine's College. NC Central's Robert Landis rears back and throws a high, tight fastball to Ontario Bell. He swings at the pitch and pops it straight up into the air. Three defensive players converge, no one calls for it, and the ball falls to the grass just as Bell pulls into second base. It's unlikely any of these Division II college players will ever compete in a major league park or play professional baseball at any level. But for every error these players make, they also show their skill with a spectacular catch in the outfield or their joy for the game by sprinting on and off the field in between innings. These players clearly love to play. But for some, including NC Central center fielder Oliver Jenkins, it's been a struggle to stay with a game that many other black players abandon as kids.
So I was the only black guy on my high school team. One thing I know for myself, that I was around it, so that made me enjoy it more. And then not really seeing a lot of black guys play, it kind of strayed away, and a lot of people, idols, would be from football or basketball, and that, you know, towards them for basketball or football.
Hey, let's go right here, defense.
A quick glance at the NC Central team in the field reveals that only a little more than half of the players are black. This is at a university where over 90% of the undergraduate student population is African American. Henry White is the NC Central coach. He's been around baseball at historically black colleges for over 30 years. He hears all the time from parents and kids that the game itself is the problem.
It's slow. They don't understand that there's a that baseball is a thinking game. They don't see that aspect of it. They see basketball, constant moving, constant playing, track, he's constantly doing something, football the same, and you got more fan support, so they don't see the what I call the game within the game.
Tyrell Godwin agrees. He was one of the country's best baseball players coming out of high school 10 years ago and is now an outfielder for the Louisville Bats, the AAA affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds. But he was often recognized more for his relatively moderate success as a football player in his small hometown of Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
As a whole, the black community, we glamorize the other sports more. In high school sports, people tend to follow basketball and football more because it's like it's more of a social event. People who follow baseball are really fans.
Godwin was selected in the first round of the 1997 baseball draft by the Yankees, but turned down New York's $2 million signing bonus to attend North Carolina on an academic scholarship, where he played baseball and football. And once there, the lack of black athletes in baseball became even more apparent.
Yeah, it was kind of discouraging at times to see as few black players playing baseball as there were, especially considering when me playing football and then when I go in a football locker room full of other black players.
But it's more than just a lack of interest that keeps African-American kids from playing baseball in college. Aaron Fitt covers NCAA baseball for Baseball America magazine. He says the emphasis placed on summer traveling teams in youth baseball has limited opportunities for kids from low-income families. And too often, that means kids of color.
It's something that's kind of seen as maybe a country club sport a little bit. It takes money to participate in these summer leagues, to go to these showcases, these kind of things to get exposure. And a lot of times, you know, it's the suburban kids, the white kids who get to do that stuff.
Which then leads to the white kids getting the baseball scholarships. But that's only a part of the problem. According to Fitt, there's not a lot of baseball scholarships for anyone.
Well, because baseball only has 11.7 scholarships to divvy up among its entire roster, very few players are on full scholarships. Some kids will be on half scholarships. Some kids will only get a book scholarship. You know, they'll get their books paid for, and that's it. But most kids don't have a lot of aid in baseball, and so a lot of them have to pay their own way.
The NCAA, like Major League Baseball, is considering ways to increase minority participation levels. One of the proposals is an increase in scholarships. And while that may help some schools diversify their rosters, it may affect the historically black schools in a different way. North Carolina Central is moving to Division I next year, and as Coach Henry White recruits better players, he's not concerned with race as much as talent and commitment. Sitting in the dugout between the two games in a doubleheader, he looks into the future. And what he sees is a very different team than the ones he's coached in the past.
That's probably the biggest major jump. I've seen major influence has been the Latino and Hispanic population in baseball of today, especially on the college level. Bethune-Cookman, Maryland Eastern Shores, all of them, you know, have a lot of Hispanics, Latino ball players.
And is that a good thing for HBCU baseball in particular?
Right now it is, because that's where you find kids who want to go to school, who are going to make the academic effort, the whole nine yards.
The irony, White says, is if baseball scholarship money does increase, so will the competition. So it's unclear what effect, if any, that will have on the number of black players who choose baseball in the future. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Let's now turn our attention to talking shrubs and literature. The story of Moses on Mount Sinai includes one example of same, as does the tale of Cyrano de Bergerac, in which the hero, hidden by a bush, rhapsodizes to his beloved Roxanne. Commentator Alyssa Eli offers another.
We were bird watching, bird listening, really. It's a little like visiting the UN when you speak only English and there are no translators. The interpretive possibilities approach infinity. We had our bird books in one hand and in the other unfolded maps of the sanctuary. If our binoculars weren't dangling around our necks, we would have had to carry them in our teeth. It takes a lot of hands to listen to birds. Near the end of a path, we found a thicket of bushes someone had told us about, a location known for particularly elusive birds. The foliage was dense and lush, and feeders were grouped all around it. We raised our binoculars. We were searching for the fox sparrow. For a long time, we stood in silence, planted in front of the bushes. Our shoes turned to roots, buds pushed out of our fingertips. A crow flew by, a car started up in the distance. Nothing else moved except our four eyes. We were utterly alone. Finally, my friend shook her head. "No one's here," she said, in a normal tone. She started to walk past the thicket back to the main path. I was folding up my map when a large shrub on my right shook itself slightly and spoke. "You girls find anything?" it said. The long end of a camera lens was poking out from under filmy military camouflage, just the color of brush, and under that a pair of unmoving boots blended perfectly with the earth. My friend didn't miss a beat. "No, not much," she said. "How about you?" It was as if she held conversations with Flora all the time. "Grackles," said the bush. It took two steps to the left, and a nose emerged from under the camouflage. "Gonna give up for today. Better luck tomorrow." "That's right," my friend said. The moment was oracular. When you think you're alone and a bush speaks to you, never mind the birds, you must listen to it utterly. If you are fortunate and have been standing in the right place, it will tell you what you've been hoping to hear. There will be better luck tomorrow.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist in Massachusetts. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. This is...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, horse racing slightly north of Kentucky and just east of the Atlantic. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
He appears to be prepared. On Thursday,
Wilbur.
Let's get to something else first. On Thursday, the Golden State Warriors, number 8 seed in the NBA's Western Conference, eliminated the number 1 seed from those playoffs. How is it that everyone seems to be in shock over the Mavericks' first-round loss, despite the fact that many predicted it?
Well, there was some talk that the Warriors' 3-0 record over Dallas in the regular season was a fluke because of this circumstance and that circumstance, and somebody was hurt, and Dallas didn't start real well this year. You know what? The Dallas Mavericks, owned by the world's smartest human, just ask him, Mark Cuban, are now 2-8 in their last 10 playoff games. And I think it's about time for Mark to just shut up and start building a basketball team that can win him a championship after spending all the money on this basketball team that can't.
Well, you mentioned Mark Cuban, but will any NBA player have a tougher offseason than Dirk Nowitzki?
No, he actually was making a late run for MVP. He didn't seem to be there in the game they needed him at. He came out with some comments afterwards where it really sounded kind of elegiac, like he realizes that somehow he's feeling like his window on his career is closed. It's very, very strange.
This week, the New York Times reported that an academic study had demonstrated that white officials in the NBA call fouls at a greater rate against black players than they do against white players. What's your take on this?
I think we should wait and see the data after it's peer-reviewed before we all leap to condemn this thing as the NBA and its kept press have. This is a serious study done by a bunch of guys who are otherwise probably pretty boring, and they know what they're doing, and they're going to submit it to a panel of guys who are probably even more boring and know even better what they're doing. So until that comes out, I think we should not take seriously the NBA study, which began in March or whatever it is. It says, no, you're wrong.
Commissioner Stern apparently thinks there could be what he called this week, quote, an NBA of China. Is this a euphemism for a giant NBA ATM in China?
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, if you know, again, it's thinking not only outside the box, but a couple of steps ahead of what's probably logistically possible. But I don't have any illusions that someday there will be a Major League Baseball franchised league in Japan or in the Caribbean somewhere, possibly in Havana after, you know, my golden dream after Fidel finally kicks, or an NBA professional league in China.
The formerly mighty Ducks of Anaheim of Los Angeles truly are mighty. They are in the NHL's Western Conference Finals. Will L.A., Anaheim of L.A. or whatever it is, finally succumb to hockey madness?
Well, they were never L.A., were they? They were always the mighty Ducks of Anaheim or the Anaheim Ducks of Anaheim or the Angels of the, or not the Angels of Anaheim, mighty Ducks up the street from Wadi Duda. But, yeah, they're certainly better than the Vancouver Canucks. And they win 4-1. They win two overtimes. They clinch the series. Rob Niedermeyer, the Niedermeyer brothers, actually had a terrific series. Jean-Sebastien Jaguar, the goalie, is 10-1 in the playoffs. And once again, you're going to wind up with a Stanley Cup for the balance of the offseason in a very strange place.
Charlie, we've talked about head injuries suffered by National Football League players before. This week, Commissioner Goodell announced that in June he will convene a meeting of medical personnel from all the teams required attendance to discuss the problem. Is this a significant development?
This is not just another study committee, which the NFL has done several times in the past, largely to prevent them from actually doing anything substantive on the problem. All the teams have to send their doctors and the trainers. The doctors and the trainers are being invited to this meeting by themselves, are sort of being enlisted by the league rather than the teams they work for, which would be a big step forward.
In post-draft news, the New England Patriots acquired Randy Moss last Sunday, a move made possible when Pats quarterback Tom Brady agreed to restructure his contract. So talk to me of sacrifice and math.
Well, I'm trying to do the math in my head. Basically, Tom Brady pushed some money he was owed back down the line a little bit so they could afford to bring Randy Moss in. What is really, absent Randy Moss's lengthy rap sheet, a very, very sweet deal for the New England Patriots. He was going to make $9.75 million from the Raiders this year. Once the trade was made, Moss tore up that contract and signed a one-year, $3 million deal that could only go up to $5 million if he meets every incentive. One of the incentives, of course, is number of catches, which he won't get because of the way the Patriots have structured their offense. Leaving aside the moral outrage and the sudden, you know, scales falling from the eyes of people that Bob Kraft isn't really running the New England Patriots as kind of public moral witness, this was a great football move.
If you were Joe Torre, would you have been sending out your resume this week?
Well, why? Because your owner has said he backs you thoroughly in everything you do? The dreaded vote of confidence.
The dreaded vote of confidence has been issued.
When the crown jewel of your farm system, Philip Hughes, the pitcher, is pitching a no-hitter in the seventh inning and celebrates that by blowing out a hamstring, gentlemen, it's not your year, okay? It's going to be a lovely summer. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the nice trips to the West Coast. But you're not going to do anything. I think this is Joe Torre's swan song in New York. I hope he's allowed to manage out the year.
I'm sure you're proud of your status as our Mr. NASCAR. Was your pride diminished this week as a result of some foolish fan behavior at the Talladega Super Speedway?
Yeah, they were throwing beer cans at the winner after Jeff Gordon won the race. This is sort of embarrassing to those of us who have a deep love and respect for NASCAR, as you know. They found 14 of the miscreants. They're going to ban them, apparently, forever from the Talladega Super Speedway. It's probably a good thing. It really was kind of embarrassing if you're pitching your sport to a national audience.
It's Derby Day, Charlie.
It is.
And Jenny Reese is on the record with her pick, so what's yours?
My pick, actually, is a horse that had a disappointing run in the Wood Memorial, but I think is better than that and is going off at 12-1, a horse called Any Given Saturday. So I'm going to give him this Saturday.
I found a website this week that's inviting us to bet on the color of Her Majesty's hat when she arrives at Churchill Downs. Do you like white/silver at 5-2?
No, actually, I think 6-1 on green is a great price, actually, because green is the queen's color.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And how he knew that the queen's color was green, I have no idea, but thank you, Charlie.
Wouldn't it be great if she had one of those hats with the two beer cans in it?
She's bought a hat like Princess Marina's to wear at all her social affairs. She wears it when she's cleaning the windows. She wears it when she's scrubbing the stairs.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast.
But she's bought a hat like Princess Marina's, so she...
Though thoroughbred racing has long been known as the sport of kings, it is a designation that would cause most people who actually work at the track to laugh if they were not too busy to do so. Nowhere is the absence of kings and the prevalence of knaves so apparent as at a racetrack like Suffolk Downs in Boston. Suffolk, which is sometimes charitably referred to as a second-level track, has been bumping and struggling and stalling through hard times for years. In Not By a Long Shot, subtitled A Season at a Hard Luck Course Track, T.D. Thornton chronicles a year in the life of the track that employed him in the public relations department. T.D. Thornton joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me.
I say welcome back because we have met at the track.
Our paths did cross at Suffolk Downs, and little did you know, although I was well aware of it back in the spring of 2000, that's when I was keeping my journal that eventually became Not By a Long Shot.
Well, the journal, which has become a book, does tell the story of the 2000 racing season at Suffolk Downs. Did you have to wait for some number of your contemporaries at the track to disappear before this book could be published?
I didn't. I actually had to wait until I took the beast that was the 700-page journal, and I culled it down and got it into actually a manageable storyline.
As the Kentucky Derby is once again making racing fans of people who do not pay any attention to the track on any other day, let's talk a little bit about what used to be Suffolk's one big day. How did the afternoon of the annual Mass Cap Stakes differ from a typical day at Suffolk Downs?
Well, it was the one big day when the track got all dressed up and was very important, and legitimately so. The Mass Cap in Boston started from humble beginnings in 1935. in its early years, horses like Seabiscuit and Whirlaway and War Admiral would come out to Suffolk Downs, and 40,000 people would get dressed up in their fedoras and fancy ladies' hats and servicemen's cap, and they'd line the grandstand from end to end. Even when Suffolk Downs had fallen on hard times by the time I was writing Not By a Long Shot in the 2000 racing season, it still was the big important day when all the fans and all the politicians and all the fastest horses in the land came to East Boston, and the atmosphere, it was absolutely electric. It was really emblematic of the sport in that a racetrack can grind along under the radar where, like you said, much like Kentucky Derby Week that we saw this past week where not too many people pay attention to it, the sport of kings rides into town on one big Saturday. And horse racing, to say it is the sport of kings, is a bit of a myth.
A bit, yes.
And we try and bust that in Not By a Long Shot. It's the sport of the working class.
The mass cap hasn't happened in three of the last 4 years. Why not?
Suffolk Downs, like a lot of mid-level joints in the racing game, has fallen on some hard times. It costs $600,000. Just that's the winning purse paid out to the winning horses in the mass cap. And it was deemed an expense that was just too dear to keep including in the budget. So the mass cap had been cut from the budget the past couple of years. I was at Suffolk Downs earlier this week, and on the same day as these things will happen, is the same day that Not By a Long Shot was published, Suffolk Downs changed hands and got a new owner for the first time in 15 years. And I have to say that the new boss does seem to be at least putting on a good show. They were ripping the joint apart and pulling out old carpet, putting in new carpet and fresh paint. So there is a bit of optimism around the old joint these days.
The former racetrack public relations man in you obviously compels you to write that nearly all horse racing is on the level, but one of my favorite stories in the book is the account of how you inadvertently stumbled into a conspiracy among jockeys to rig a race. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I like to say when people ask me, in fact, that's usually the first thing people ask you when they come out to the track is, are the races fixed? And I like to say that the answer is no, for the most part, and the analogy that I like to give is that the game is like ivory soap. It's 99.44% pure, but if that 0.56 touch of larceny didn't exist, it wouldn't be any fun. The story that I outline in Not By a Long Shot involves a snippet of conversation I overhear two jockeys very brazenly, openly discussing their strategy for how the race is going to be scripted. And a lot of times you'll see in horse racing where the veteran jockeys, it's a very political type of atmosphere, in that the guys at the top have a stranglehold over some of the lower jockeys on the totem pole. And here's a new kid that blows into town. He's 21 years old. He's never won a race before. With a wink and a nudge, the jockeys say, hey, kid, you're having a hard time. Maybe we can help you out and get you into the winner's circle. The kid thinks that this is a very altruistic move. However, the jockeys are all going to be sending their runners upstairs to bet their brains out on this horse. And it was one thing to overhear the snippet of conversation that these jockeys were very openly and brazenly talking about in the locker room, but another to step out into the paddock myself and see that the odds on this hopeless, hapless long shot, who should have legitimately been 30 or 40 or 50 to 1, she was the 8-5 betting favorite in the race. So that was the red flag right there. And what they're going to do is they're going to get out on the lead and control the pace. And when they come to the top of the turn for all the money, one of them, the horse who's supposed to be the betting favorite, the horse who everybody else that's not in on the fix thinks it's going to be, forgets to turn left at the top of the stretch and all of a sudden careens out towards the grandstand fence. The rookie jockey's horse is just spinning her wheels. She can't get her traction in the mud, and she never does win the race. In fact, she doesn't even finish in the money.
No, but it's a wonderful story, and I love the fact that the jockey, the veteran jockey who's tried to set this all up, watches the replay and said, I should have gone further right. I mean, he couldn't have unless he wanted to go right into Revere.
He could have gone out into the parking lot, and it wouldn't have been wide enough in that case.
Another excellent story, and this one doesn't take place at Suffolk Downs, but at Rockingham Park, just up Route 93 from Suffolk in New Hampshire. The story explains how a veteran track announcer lost his position. Tell us about the fall of Big Jim Hannon.
Big Jim Hannon was a legend around these parts, and he is often referred to as the voice of New England racing. And anybody who went to Suffolk Downs during the 50s, 60s, or 70s remembers the big bass, gravelly voice that I really can't do. But it left Suffolk Downs in 1989 when the track closed, and he resurfaced at Rockingham Park a couple of years later when their track announcer got busted for growing marijuana in his house, so they had to kick him out the door. He calls for a couple of seasons, and one day, after a particularly forgettable, low-level, bottom-of-the-barrel claiming race, Big Jim turns to a friend in the press box, in his announcer's stand, and says, "They're all rats. I don't know how anybody can bet on these things." And unfortunately, he failed to turn off his open microphone before he said that, and as a result, he had to hang up his binoculars.
So, thousands of customers hear perhaps the most knowledgeable man on the premises say, "They're all rats. I don't know how anybody can bet on these things."
And regardless of the truth in his statement, Rockingham Park management elected to differ with him.
You write that, I'm quoting now, "In horse racing, defeat is a far cry from failure." I'm not entirely sure what that means, but it sounds so good that maybe that saying should be painted over the turnstiles at Suffolk, where you first go into the track, and at various other second-level tracks.
I think defeat being a far cry from failure kind of speaks to a lot of the people at Suffolk Downs, the people who toil anonymously for 40 years, and again, not just at Suffolk Downs, but at all the mid-level joints that help support the game. There's a lot of good people back there. You never hear their stories. We're at a time of the season when you hear about the cream of the crop, the pinnacle of the profession. You see a lot of fawning portrayals of champion jockeys and champion thoroughbreds and the people with a lot of money who are able to bankroll their way to the top of the game. But isn't it just as noble to see somebody who busts their back for 40 years in the game? They certainly don't do it for the money. They do it out of a raw, visceral love of the horse, and also for that one chance. Horse racing, if it's got any one redeeming quality, it's that hope always exists. When the races are done every day, there's always going to be 9 more tomorrow to go get them. If you have a stable full of cheap, broken-down horses that aren't earning their oats, you never know. The next secretariat could be hiding under a blanket waiting to come into your shed row next. And that's, for example, if you go way back into history, that's how Seabiscuit came into being. Mm-hmm. He was a horse that nobody wanted at Suffolk Downs in the 1930s, and he became such an equine sensation that his story still rings true today to some people.
T.D. Thornton is the author of Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track, published by Public Affairs. He joined me right here in the studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Hit him hard in the Derby.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Maggie Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Not by a Long Shot, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from assistant trainer Terry Smith, who talks about methods used to minimize the buildup of polytrack particles on horses' hooves.
Well, we would spray like PAM, cooking spray. WD-40 seemed to work pretty good.
And there are some trainers who would assert that a balm made of equal parts dippity-doo, chicken fat, and banana peels is even more effective. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org.